So, in the middle of the parsha, subsequent to Yaakov's triumph over Esav, and prior to the great encounter and conflict with Shechem, there's a small section where Yaakov purchases land in Eretz Yisrael. It's really the first time that a Jew appears to purchase land in an uncontested fashion, unlike Beersheba, unlike Hebron. And doesn't just purchase land, but he begins to interact with his co-inhabitants. He builds Sukkot for himself, a bayis for his animals, a Sukkot. He arrives at the city of Shechem. He's in a perfect state. He begins to ingratiate himself. He begins to vayichan es pnei ha'ir, take steps for public welfare in ways that create harmonious relations, which will soon sour. He purchases land, vayikin es chalkas asada, he built a mizbeach. He purchases land from Chamor, so that invites the devil into the chicken hen or into the chicken coop. And the Torah tells us about how much money he paid to purchase Shechem. Mea kesita. So first of all, it was featured prominently in a very well-known medrash, which I've quoted several times, about three cities having been paid for with full price, with a full amount. One is Hebron, one is Yerushalayim by David HaMelech, and one is Shechem. So in a very strange medrash, Yehuda ben Simon says, Ze'echad mishloshim ekamos, Rav Yudan bar Simon, She'enu masa'olam yachol honas es Yisrael. These are one of the three cities that there's no way they can be contested, no way they can be challenged, there's no way that the international community can claim that these three cities are occupied illegally, because we paid for them in full detail, Maris HaMachpelah and Hebron, Beis HaMikdash, Shechem, and he quotes this pasuk, which articulates in very, very clear and certain terms that Yaakov paid full price, Mea Kesita, for this land. And unfortunately, it seems as if these three lands are the most contested, Maris HaMachpelah, Shechem, and Yerushalayim, unlike some of the other lands, which weren't acquired with such financial remuneration. In any event, the Torah describes how much he paid for it by describing it as mea kesita. Now, the word kesita is a very strange word. So Rashi interprets this as mea mana, 100 mos measurements, mem ayin hei, very well-known monetary measurement, leaving open the question of what kesita means and why is a strange word employed. So Rabbi Akiva says, Rashi quotes Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva was a world traveler, frequent flyer, frequent sailor, in part because he was on various diplomatic missions. Presumably there were other reasons he traveled, but it's very clear that he represented the Jewish people in their endeavors to still stabilize a very vulnerable condition in the post-Chorban environment. And the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah quotes many different statements of Rabbi Akiva about how words that are known and that are organic to the Hebrew language were used in other languages to refer to certain objects. It's a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, on Daf Chavav. The introduction on Chavav is how do we know that the word Yovel means the horn of a ram? The word Yovel is employed both in Yisro as well as in Parshas Bahar to describe the horn of a shofar. And the Gemara wants to know how we know that it refers to a shofar. And the Gemara quotes Rabbi Akiva, who visited an Arabic land, and they would call a horn of a ram a yovel. And he visited a place called Galia, and they would call Anida a galmuda. He visited Afriki, and they called ma'a, which was a certain measurement of coins, they called it kesita. And Rashi, there's a parenthesis in Rashi. It's not clear whether it just is a way to refer to a certain volume of money or particularly quality and caliber form of money to demonstrate that Yaakov paid healthy and non-decomposing coins. But either way, the question remains, why does the Torah choose to employ a term which is more associated with an international language rather than a classic word of zuz or ma, whatever equivalent in classic Hebrew would refer to those coins? And what it appears to be is that the Torah chooses international words when it's describing events that have international meaning. So, for example, Rabbi Akiva famously in the Gemara Menachos interpreted the word totafos, which is a reference to Tefillin Shel Rosh, as four, because in Africa the word tat means two and the word pot means two. So tat pot or totafot means four and corresponds to the four parashios in our Tefillin. Now, why would Tefillin be described in a foreign word? Because Tefillin Shel Rosh, unlike Tefillin Shel Yad, are meant to be demonstrable, meant to be visible. V'ro'u kol amei aretz ki shem Hashem nikra alecha v'yaru b'mecha. So unlike the Tefillin Shel Yad, which is a private v'haya lechalios, a private keepsake or a private message for the bearer and the wearer, Tefillin Shel Rosh are meant to have not just a projected and broadcasted function, but broadcasting to an international audience, the shin, the dalet, the yud, based on that pasuk, v'ro'u kol amei aretz ki shem Hashem nikra alecha. So it's only appropriate that these tefillin that have an international appeal, international agenda, should be referred to in a foreign language. I think the same issue is in play in this Gemara, which Rashi quotes, that this is Yaakov's international moment, this is Yaakov's attempt to build bridges with the broader community, and the broader community in Eretz Yisrael, and to pay money, and to build public works. So the money he's paying should be described in a foreign language. So it's one thing for Rashi to help us decode what these foreign words mean. It's another thing to question why the Torah chooses these particular locations to describe these foreign words. And you'd have to go through the entire list in Rosh Hashanah, which I won't go through at this point, why the list six or seven cases in which Rabbi Akiva helped decode, but why does the Torah select strange words rather than employing classic internal Hebrew words? What's also interesting is to see how these Hebrew words worm their way into various languages. So the word kesita, which was written in the Torah, was then employed in Africa to refer to a certain volume of money and had been forgotten almost in the Hebrew language, so that people required Rabbi Akiva to inform them of this word that was indigenous to Hebrew, that now had infiltrated other languages and had almost been severed from classic Hebrew, and so on and so forth with some of the other words that Rabbi Akiva identified and decoded. And evidently Hebrew is the base language, and possibly during Migdal Bavel, where there was a scattering of populations and a differentiation of languages, so there were remnants of Hebrew that infiltrated or that remained as vestiges in various languages. And part of the Gemara's quoting all these cases indicates the centrality linguistically and etymologically of the Hebrew language. Another interesting Rashi about a conversation between Yaakov and his children about a clear barrel of wine. Yaakov accuses his children, he's angry by their decision to avenge Dinah's rape. He uses an interesting word. He accuses them by saying, achartem osi. You have, achartem osi means you have made me disturbed, you've made me lacking tranquility. When water is disturbed and agitated, it becomes cloudy, it becomes almost muddy. So Yaakov uses a very, very strange word to describe how he feels his son's rash and impetuous actions have subverted his agenda, have subverted his standing and his presence amongst his neighbors. So Rashi quotes a conversation based on the Medrash, but Rashi only quotes a segment of the Medrash. The continuation of the Medrash, for some reason, Rashi omits. The Medrash describes that Yaakov turned to his sons and said, Salula haisa hachavis. The barrel, which in this case is a metaphor, the barrel of wine, was clear, was settled, was tranquil, was serene. Even though two different populations live side by side with cross purposes, and interestingly enough, astonishingly so, the local inhabitants were well aware of the divine promise of the Jewish people, yet they weren't chafing at it, they weren't disappointed by it, because they felt that they still had many generations until this divine prophecy would actualize. They were aware, if not of the pasuk in Mishpatim, but they were certainly aware of the condition of Ad asher tifre v'nechalta ha'aretz, that Hashem had promised, or in some cases had cautioned us, that our conquest of Israel would be staged until we had enough population to both warrant and to properly execute a full inheritance. So Hashem informs us that our conquest and our extension of sovereignty over Eretz Yisrael will be staged. So first of all, it's independent of the story of Yaakov, it's a reminder, I won't say sad reminder, but it's a bittersweet reminder that our extension of sovereignty in Israel is in direct proportion to the population that swells and that visits Israel. And so it was true in the contrast between the first Beis HaMikdash and the second, and unfortunately very few people returned. And the sovereignty was very fledgling, and Chazal were already aware of this. Gemara Megillah, Daf Tes. And sadly, we're still living through part of that struggle, where the return to Eretz Yisrael is still partial, some ways marginal, and we haven't been able to extend full sovereignty, and we're still living under the guidelines of Ma'at Mata Garshenu, where our growth and our sovereignty in this land is incremental rather than complete and quantum. But Yaakov is highlighting the relative tranquility that exists between himself and his neighbors, because though they inhabit two different worlds ideologically, and each ideology sees a very different agenda, at this point, there's no reason for those cross purposes to flare into conflict, because there's a common denominator. Yaakov wants to advance his agenda, and they want to live in their momentary agenda, and even though they're not willing long-term to cede the land of Israel, right now there's no difference. And as long as there's no difference, Yaakov's happy to advance his presence and even to tolerate, so to speak, the rape of his daughter without responding and retaliating in violent form. And I think it makes us think a lot about some of the people that we live with, quote-unquote, and we're meant to live with, quote-unquote, in Israel until we extend full sovereignty. I'm thinking in particular of Christian fundamentalists who have a certain plot that they chart their eschatology, their messianic endgame, and a very specific task for Jews in that endgame and in their messianic trajectory or their messianic narrative. And many Jews feel very uncomfortable collaborating with them financially, politically, because how can we collaborate with people who see us as props towards a very, very different endpoint, towards the return of Jesus? So in their minds, Jews have to live in Israel so that Jesus can be resurrected, and obviously this is all bunk to us. But on the other hand, in 2017, if we both have the same agenda, namely the Jews to settle the land of Israel, is it really so inappropriate to be pairing with people as long as there's practical cross purposes or practical common purposes? So it's an interesting statement of Yaakov, that the barrel was very clear and you muddied it and muddled it. Now what's interesting is the part that Rashi doesn't quote. And this is where the brothers turn back to Yaakov, so to speak, and they respond and they say, what do you mean the barrel was clear? The barrel was muddied because they were treating us with disrespect and sexual exploitation and violence. So you're assuming a reality, they tell their father, which the barrel was clear and we were the ones who muddied it. And when in truth, the barrel was quite muddled before we entered the picture. And in some ways, this is highlighting a contrast, that Yaakov has an agenda to settle the land of Israel. And the brothers have an agenda to install moral code, moral guidelines, punish those who are moral criminals, perpetrate crimes, violent crimes against others. And they each see the terms of clarity and muddled waters very differently. For Yaakov, he's following a historical agenda to establish a Jewish presence in Eretz Yisrael, which ultimately will create a moral beacon and radically transform human morality. Whereas the brothers, as we would say, aren't really playing long ball. They're playing short ball. They're saying, right now we live here, and whatever long-term historical agendas you project and whatever injustices and offenses you're willing to tolerate in order to advance that agenda and to keep things calm, there's a certain moral threshold. Once it gets violated, we just can't allow that. And And there's really no right or wrong answer. It's a very interesting debate, and I'm not sure the Torah really concludes or awards one of these positions as being correct. It's a teku, as we say in the Gemara. And it's a teku, again, not just in the moral question about whether you should kill someone who rapes your sister or your daughter, but it's a moral question because there are two very, very different agendas at work. Yaakov wants to establish the Jewish people in the land of Israel. He's wanting to make compromises and concessions for the long-term benefits. The brothers are saying in the short term there's just a certain values that have to be upheld and injustices that have to be responded to. And how do you see the barrel? Is the barrel being muddied by their response, or was the barrel muddied by this behavior? And you can't just live in a tranquil barrel when such injustices are being perpetrated.